And with that music, it's obviously birthday time here on Iris, and we have three birthdays we're celebrating this April 9th. Marilyn K. Schweitzer of Cedar Rapids, Sherry Bush of Sac City, and Christine L. Smart of Des Moines. So a very happy birthday to Marilyn K., Sherry, and Christine, and hope you have a terrific birthday. Iris does have a limited number of free tickets to the Sunday, April 14th, 2 p.m. performance of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, with live audio description at the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Beautiful tells the story of the early life and career of Carole King, weaving a tapestry, with songs that she wrote throughout. If you're interested, please give us a call here at the Iris office, and that number is 515-243-6833. Again, 515-243-6833 if you'd like tickets to the Beautiful, the Carole King musical playing at the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Well, you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Deanna with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Pat. Dennis Hurley, sometimes known as Doc Savage, a passionate bicyclist and loving family man, transitioned into the afterlife at age 86 on April 5th. Known to many as Denny, he was set up on his stage on November 20th, 1937 in Ryan, Iowa, to Francis and Lucille Chambers Hurley. He met his loving wife Shirley while out dancing several decades ago. They were married for more than 66 years. Dennis and Shirley resided in Perry for 34 years. They moved to Des Moines in 2004, living in Beaverdale for nearly 20 years. Dennis played organized basketball until the age of 66. As a child, after grade school, he attended Dowling High School when it was an all-boys school, graduating with a class of 1956. Dennis and Jim Wallstrom were the co-founders of BRR, the annual Bike Ride to Rippey, a yearly 24-mile trek on the first Saturday in February. He is survived by his wife Shirley and their four children. Visitation will be at the Isles Westover Funeral Home on Hickman Road on Wednesday, April 10th from 5 to 7 p.m. And funeral will be at Holy Trinity Catholic Church on Beaver Avenue on Thursday, April 11th at 10 o'clock. Marlis Ruth Thornton of West Des Moines, a beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and co-founder of Merrick Refrigeration, peacefully passed away on April 6th. Marlis was born on April 25th in 1936 in northern Iowa to Christine and Clifford Anderson. She grew up on the farm alongside her sister Joan and her brother Wayne. She developed a close bond with her siblings. Embracing her tomboy nature, she reveled in the joys of hard work, adventure, and mischief, often leading her siblings into fun-filled escapades. After graduating from Williams High School, she attended a local dance party and met a young man named Richard Thornton. Within a few months, they were married and they enjoyed 64 wonderful years together. They were blessed with four children. From 1967 to 1984, Marlis worked for the House of Decorative Accessories, starting as a salesperson and rising to become a district and then regional sales manager. Marlis and Dick were a great team. While she grew her career at HODA, she supported the family, enabling Dick to realize his dream of founding Merrick Refrigeration. In 97, they embraced retirement in Las Vegas, where they experienced great joy. After 20 years in Las Vegas, they moved back to Iowa to be closer to children and grandchildren. Richard passed away last May. Services will be held at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines on Wednesday, April 10th. With visitation from 11:30 until 1:30, and the service beginning at 1:30 p.m. Betty Leonard of Ankeny passed away on April 6th. She was born on January 20th, 1930, to Emmett and Irene Carlson from Sheldahl, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th, at Ankeny First United Methodist Church. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, April 12th, also at the church. Following the service, she'll be laid to rest at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Betty attended and was a graduate of Sheldahl High School, where she was a member of the basketball team. She married the love of her life, Eldon, on December 31st, 1948, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. Then they moved to Ankeny, where they raised three children. She worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield, Iowa Home Mutual, and was a school secretary for 26 and a half years at Neville and Parkview Middle School in Ankeny. She was a member of the Ankeny First United Methodist Church, an avid fan of the Iowa Cyclones. She was preceded in death by her husband, Eldon, her parents, Irene and Emmett, and two brothers. She is survived by her children, Steve Leonard and Daniel Leonard. Sherry Baker of Urbandale, age 78, passed away surrounded by those who loved her on April 5th at Taylor House in Des Moines. Funeral service will be held privately. Sharon Shellstrom was born to Marlon Shelley and Patricia Wolf Shellstrom on January 18, 1946, in Maryville, Missouri. She attended high school at Urbandale High School in Iowa and began working for Wyckoff Industries until 1998. She married her high school sweetheart, Michael Baker, on September 11, 1965, where they raised their family in Urbandale. Sherry loved her family and spending time with her grandchildren, especially at their sporting events. Sherry is survived by two children, Kurt, married to Michelle Baker, and Shelley, married to Scott Thompson, her brother, Mark, and one great-grandchild on the way. Sherry is preceded in death by her husband. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorial contributions to the Kia Koda Animal Shelter in Indianola. And then I just have to make a notice on a little article that I missed here on the front page of Metro in Iowa. How Waukee students are showing support for Perry following the shooting, sending cards and $5,400. This is from Philip Sitter. A Waukee elementary school is providing Perry schools with financial and moral support following a shooting at Perry High School in January. Students from kindergarten, second, and fifth grade at Sugar Creek Elementary in Waukee on Friday afternoon made cards to accompany a $5,400 check to Perry schools raised by Sugar Creek Elementary PTO. A hand-drawn card from second grader Jacob Goebel read, "And kindness is in this world. Everybody show kindness every time in your life." A 17-year-old Perry High School student on January 4th shot and killed 11-year-old Amir Jolief, fatally wounding Perry High School principal Dan Marburger and injured two other staff members and four students before taking his own life. Sugar Creek fifth grader Tanishka Theranipathy says, "It's important to support Perry students because they went through a lot." And a second grader, Caleb Van Leeuwen, said of making cards, "It's a good thing to do." Second grade teacher Laura Butcher, whose classroom hosted the students from second and fifth grades to make the cards on Friday, said showing empathy is an important skill for students to develop at a young age. I think that's a noble thing that they've done. Back to you, Pat.
Thank you, Dan. Very nice. Finishing up in the Metro in Iowa section, a 23-year term given to a member of a Des Moines gang. He pleaded guilty to gun and drug trafficking counts. Byung Byung of the Register wrote this article. A Des Moines gang member was sentenced to serve 23 years in federal prison after pleading guilty to a weapon and drug trafficking charge. Federal prosecutors say Armani Eugene Gates, age 20, is a member of Only My Brothers, or OMB, a gang that the Des Moines police previously have said is in a war with STRAP, or OTR, meaning Only the Real. The two parties prosecutors contend to be at the core of the Starts Right Here shooting. Gates pleaded guilty to federal charges related to firearms straw purchasing and trafficking, illegally possessing firearms, and the distribution of fentanyl, according to a news release from the U.S. Department of Justice. The release says that following the execution of a search warrant in July, police recovered 13,000 fentanyl pills, seven firearms, and one machine gun conversion device, and $23,000 in cash. In addition, Gates led efforts to acquire and distribute over 3.5 kilograms of fentanyl. Gates employed others to assist him in his drug operation, including at least one minor, the press release says. And it adds he also possessed a firearm in connection with his drug trafficking, as well as utilized residences to store his fentanyl. After serving his sentence, Gates will be required to serve 5 years of supervised release. Gates was arrested as part of the Project Safe Neighborhood, a nationwide initiative to reduce violent crime in neighborhoods. Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert said in a release, "Since the inception of Project Safe Neighborhoods, there has been numerous investigations and prosecutions that have had a significant impact on violent crime in central Iowa. This is simply another example of what success looks like, which should send a clear message to those in our communities who are involved in violent crime." OMB originated in early to mid-2021, prosecutors previously have said. Prior to that, some members and associates of OMB referred to themselves as various other names, including C-Block, 600, East Side Crips, and Gangster. The OMB gang has been in the spotlight as prosecutors alleged the two victims in the 2023 shooting at Starts Right Here were part of it. Police said the shooting happened because of a rivalry between OMB and Only the Real, a gang in which they alleged the accused shooter and now acquitted getaway driver were a part of. The case against Gates was investigated by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the Des Moines Police Department, and the United States Postal Inspection Service, with assistance from the Iowa Division of Narcotics Enforcement, Iowa State Patrol, and the Iowa Division of Intelligence and Fusion Center. And then one other short article. One number off from the Powerball jackpot in Iowa wins $1 million. Kyle Werner of the Register wrote this article. One lucky Iowan won $1 million in the Powerball drawing early Sunday with the $1,326 billion jackpot going to an Oregon ticket holder. The ticket in Iowa was sold in Newton. And the Iowa Powerball ticket matched five of the six numbers for the grand prize, the Iowa Lottery said in a news release. It was one of seven $1 million prizes won across the country as a jackpot, which had accumulated for 3 months, tied the game's record for the longest string of consecutive drawings without a winner. It was the fourth largest Powerball prize on record and the eighth largest in the history of U.S. lotteries. The drawing was set to take place Saturday night, but was delayed to about 2:30 a.m. Sunday because required pre-draw procedures were not completed, said the Urbandale-based Multi-State Lottery Association, which administers the game. The lottery said that Iowans spent about $2.4 million on tickets in the Powerball drawing. The winning numbers were 22, 27, 44, 52, 69, and the Powerball was 9. The Power Play number was 3. Deanna?
Okay, and the last article in the Metro and Iowa section. Eclipse excitement hits its peak. This is out of Eagle Pass, Texas, and written by Doyle Rice, John Bacon, Rick Jervis, and George Ortiz. After weeks of buildup and anticipation, in a moment of cosmic alignment that was precisely predicted, yet undeniably mysterious, the edge of the moon crept across the edge of the sun just after noon local time. The eclipse had begun. Alejandra Martinez, a seventh grade science teacher in this border city, sat with a telescope in the corner of the county airport. Martinez, age 42, and two other science enthusiasts had been recruited by NASA to participate in Citizen KATE 2024, where more than 30 teams perched in the eclipse's path, recording the shadowy track. Eagle Pass sat near the very beginning of the eclipse's track and at near dead center, where the period of totality will be the longest. That total shadow was still more than an hour away when sky began to darken. Martinez, dressed in a This Totally Rocks shirt, peered up with anxiously at the gray, gauzy sky as the penumbra crept across the airfield, looking like millions at the sky. She put on her eclipse glasses. Just then, the sky's gauzy clouds parted. "There it is! There it is!" she yelled. "First contact! It's begun!" All over the country, as the sun rose Monday, everyone couldn't wait until the moment it disappeared again. The rare event, an astronomical experience like none other, was unusually accessible to millions of Americans. It was widely anticipated not only for its remarkable length of totality, but for its timing. No total solar eclipse will be visible for the contiguous United States until 2044. Some fans drove for hours seeking the clearest view of darkness. A fifth grader, Mazi Pelham of Baltimore, watched the news of the 2017 solar eclipse. "I said to myself, I would go to the next one," he said. "It's a promise I made to myself." Which is why he and his parents, Janice and Sonny Pelham, left Maryland around 1 a.m. on Monday and drove nearly 7 hours to Rochester, New York. Some went even farther. In Mazatlan, Mexico, the first point on land to view totality, Elizabeth Rigdon and her son Christopher Kirk celebrated their first time traveling outside the U.S. and their first time viewing a total solar eclipse. "I can't stop smiling. I'm so glad we did this," Reagan said. "Now we think we want to start chasing eclipses." On the other hand, some went just a few subway stops, exiting the train by Brooklyn's Prospect Park with a folded lawn chair strapped across his shoulder and a pair of paper eclipse glasses. Ralph Emerson said he felt energized. "This is special," he said, 61 years old. "I haven't woken up with this much excitement since the Super Bowl." Appreciating natural phenomena makes it easier to manage the stresses that come with living in a big city, he said, and in this case, to feel a sense of community. A lot of times, he said, it's tragedies that bring us together, but sometimes things like this do. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Returning now to the main section or front page of Des Moines Register articles. This one is on page 5A. Trump says he opposes a national ban on abortion. David Jackson of USA Today wrote this article. Former President Donald Trump said Monday he does not support a national ban on abortion and that each state should decide any restrictions on the procedure, an attempt to ease the political pressure on an issue that has hurt Republicans in recent elections. Trump said in a video statement posted on his Truth Social platform, adding, "At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people. Now it's up to the states to do the right thing." President Joe Biden and his supporters, who have made abortion a top issue in the 2024 race for the White House, said that Trump has been a massive threat to abortion rights by appointing Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade ruling. Democrats have used abortion rights to fuel voter turnout since the end of Roe v. Wade, and they've notched wins with referendums and ballot measures on abortion access across the country. They hope to do the same this fall. After Trump's announcement, Democrats pointed out that Trump has given at least tacit support to Republican-backed restrictions in the states, including a six-week abortion ban in his home state of Florida. "Donald Trump is endorsing every single abortion ban in the states, including abortion bans with no exceptions," said Biden campaign spokesperson Amar Moussa, posted on X, and he's bragging about his role in creating this hellscape. Florida is holding an abortion rights referendum in the fall. Biden aides say that measure will drive voters to the polls and make Democrats competitive in a must-win state for Trump. But Trump didn't face criticism from Democrats alone. Some groups that oppose abortion took aim at Trump's opting out of the federal debate. Marjorie Dannensfeller, president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, said, "We are deeply disappointed in President Trump's position." She said that letting the states decide cedes the national debate to the Democrats. During his political career, Trump has always had an equivocal relationship with the abortion issue. In the 1990s, Trump publicly said he supported abortion rights. But the former president avidly sought the support of religious conservatives and activists who opposed abortion rights during his 2016 presidential campaign. In this presidential campaign, Trump has proclaimed that, quote, "I killed Roe v. Wade," unquote, but he has also warned Republicans to be careful about how they deal with the issue because it has hurt them in elections, including his own reelection bid in 2020 and congressional races in 2022. In recent weeks, Trump aides suggested that he might back a 15 or 16-week national abortion ban, echoing some new state laws, but Trump did not raise the issue in his video on Monday. In that message, Trump stressed his support for exceptions in the case of rape, incest, and severe medical emergencies. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. On page 7, Hamas, out of Hamas, Gaza truce talks have deadlocked. Netanyahu sets a date for invasion of Rafah. This is Dateline Cairo. Hamas rejected an Israeli ceasefire proposal made at talks in Cairo, a senior Hamas official said on Monday, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date was set for an invasion of Rafah, Gaza's last refuge for displaced Palestinians. Israel and Hamas sent teams to Egypt on Sunday for talks that included Qatari and Egyptian mediators, as well as CIA Director William Burns. Burns's presence underlined rising pressure from Israel's main ally, the U.S., for a deal that would free Israeli hostages held in Gaza and get aid to Palestinian civilians left destitute by 6 months of conflict. But senior Hamas official Ali Baraka told Reuters, "We reject the latest Israeli proposals that the Egyptian side informed us of. The Politburo met today and decided this." Another Hamas official had earlier told Reuters that no progress had been made in the negotiations. There is no change in the position of the occupation in Israel, and therefore there is nothing new in the Cairo talks, a Hamas official who asked not to be identified told Reuters. There is no progress yet. Details of the proposal were not immediately known. In Jerusalem on Monday, a day after Israeli forces pulled back from some areas of southern Gaza, Netanyahu said he had received a detailed report on the talks in Cairo. He said, "We are constantly working to achieve our goals, first and foremost, the release of all our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. This victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date." He did not specify the date. Rafah is the last refuge for Palestinian civilians displaced by relentless Israeli bombardments that have flattened their home neighborhoods. It is also the last significant redoubt of Hamas combat units, Israel says. Reboot, I think that is. More than 1 million people are crammed into this southern city in desperate conditions, short of food, water, and shelter, and foreign governments and organizations have urged Israel against storming Rafah for fears of a bloodbath. Hundreds of residents who had been living in tents in Rafah ventured back to their devastated home areas on Monday following the Israeli pullback. Some rode on donkey carts, rickshaws, and open-deck vehicles, while some just walked. "It is a shock. A shock. The destruction is unbearable," said resident Mohammed Abu Diab. "I'm going to my house and I know it's destroyed. I'm going to remove the rubble to get a shirt out," he said. Palestinian medical officials said their teams had recovered more than 80 bodies from areas where the soldiers operated in the past months. Western powers have voiced concern over the high Palestinian civilian death toll and the humanitarian crisis arising from Israel's military onslaught to destroy Hamas in the densely populated Gaza Strip. Some 33,207 Palestinians have been killed in 6 months of conflict, Gaza's health ministry said in an update on Monday. Most of the enclave's 2.3 million people are homeless and many risk of famine. Hamas killed 1,200 people in southern Israel in the cross-border attack on October 7th that triggered the conflict, according to Israeli tallies. The Israeli army says over 600 of its soldiers have been killed in combat since. In Washington, a White House spokesperson said the U.S. hoped to secure a hostage release deal as soon as possible, since it would also lead to a ceasefire of around 6 weeks. Over the weekend, Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz described the Cairo talks as the closest the sides have come to a deal since a short-lived November truce under which Hamas freed nearly half of its hostages. Of the 253 people Hamas seized on October 7th, 133 hostages remained captive. Negotiators have spoken of around 40 going free in the first stage of a prospective deal. Earlier on Monday, two Egyptian security sources and state-run Al-Qahira News said some progress had been made in the Cairo talks. They said both sides had made concessions that could lead to a deal for a three-stage truce with the release of any remaining Israeli hostages and a long-term ceasefire addressed in the second stage. The concessions relate to freeing of hostages and Hamas's demand for return of displaced residents to northern Gaza, they said. Mediators suggested the return could be monitored by an Arab force in the presence of Israeli security deployments that would later be pulled back, they said. Delegations left Cairo and consultations were expected to continue within 48 hours, the sources and Al-Qahira said. However, a Palestinian official close to mediation efforts told Reuters that deadlock continued over Israel's refusal to end the war, withdraw forces from Gaza, allow all civilians to return to their homes, and lift a 17-year blockade that allow a speedy reconstruction of the coastal enclave. These steps took precedence over Israel's prime demand for a release of hostages in exchange for Palestinians held in Israeli prisons, said the official, speaking on condition of anonymity. Regarding the exchange of prisoners, Hamas was and is willing to be more flexible, but there is no flexibility over our main demands, he said. Israel has ruled out ending the war shortly or withdrawing from Gaza, saying its forces will not relent until Hamas no longer controls Gaza or threatens Israel militarily. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. And our final story from the main section, Des Moines Register, new student loan forgiveness is on tap. Biden offers new plans after justices nixed his first. President Joe Biden's administration gave a much-anticipated preview Monday of his final plan to bring student debt forgiveness to millions of Americans. More than 4 million student loan borrowers, many of whom have been paying their bills down for the last 20 years, could see their debt fully canceled under the proposal, according to the White House. In addition, over 10 million borrowers could get relief of $5,000 or more. Biden also hopes to eliminate interest past the original loan amounts of 23 million borrowers, though experts say the regulations aren't expected to fully take effect until July of next year at the earliest. The Department of Education is considering taking actions to expedite parts of the plan, possibly bringing relief to some borrowers as soon as this fall. The announcement represents the most aggressive actions Biden has committed to yet in hopes of making up for the Supreme Court's rebuke of his first student loan relief gambit, which would have canceled up to $20,000 in student loan debt for millions of low- and middle-income borrowers. Though the final regulation still hasn't been released and likely won't be set in stone for months, the White House's eagerness to promote it underscores just how central student loan forgiveness has become to Biden's reelection efforts. Biden and his surrogates, including Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, Vice President Kamala Harris, and Second Gentleman Douglas Emhoff, were fanning out across the United States on Monday to tout the proposal. Administration officials say they're confident the plan will pass legal muster, but that doesn't mean potential court challenges won't derail the federal government's timeline for waiving debt. The bungled rollout of a new college financial aid form, meanwhile, has prompted Republicans in recent weeks to criticize the Education Department for prioritizing student loan forgiveness. On a call with reporters Sunday, Cardona said the administration remains unapologetic about its aggressive debt cancellation strategies. It means breathing room, he said. It means freedom from feeling like your student loan bills compete with basic needs like grocery or health care. Biden's first try at delivering broad student loan forgiveness relief relied on his emergency authorization activities during the pandemic. Legal challenges halted the plan before it got off the ground, though, and last summer the Supreme Court struck it down. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we will take a short break to allow our next readers, Dale and Scott, to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splevic. We're going to continue with the articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Scott with our next article.
Thank you, Doug. We'll start with the opinion. It's entitled, Biden's Israel Support is Frustrating Gen Z. It's written by Sarah Pequeño of USA Today. And you can follow USA Today elections columnist Sarah Pequeño on X, formerly Twitter, at Sarah, S-A-R-A, underscore Pequeño, P-E-Q-U-E-N-O, and on Facebook at facebook.com/Pequeño Writes. Cameron Jones is a sophomore at Columbia University. He has family in Israel and has visited more than once, but he also is a member of the college's chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP, and a vocal opponent of Israel's attack on Gaza. His family abroad doesn't know about the organizing he has done, nor do they know that Jones is one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the university after the JVP chapter was suspended last November. Since Hamas strikes prompted Israel to begin attacking Gaza on October the 7th, Jones and other students, mostly queer people, people of color, and women, have been organizing to demand Columbia divest from companies and institutions that support Israel. I feel as though I have more of a duty to stand up against what is wrong, Jones told me. Nearly 33,000 Palestinians have died in the past 6 months. The images and information coming out of the Gaza Strip, like the Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers last week, have been difficult to see. Calling for an end to the conflict is important to the nation's youngest voters, and President Joe Biden needs to take a firm stance on the issue ahead of the election. If the president called for a ceasefire, even a short-term one, it would likely be taken seriously by Israel. Biden has come out against the dangers that civilians in the region are facing, but it's not enough. If your social media feed is anything like mine, you've seen documentation of the catastrophe of building after bombings, families in refugee camps, and glimpses into the lives of people who have died. The cause has even reached dating apps where users are specifying their stances on Gaza or simply including the Palestinian flag in their bios. This social media campaign is probably why so many young voters are supporting Palestinians compared with previous flare-ups in the regions. In a New York Times Siena poll from December, 55% of respondents age 18 to 29 opposed the United States sending more aid to Israel. A poll from Quinnipiac University in November found that 52% of voters younger than age 35 are more sympathetic to the Palestinians. However, not everyone in this demographic is on the same page. An NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll conducted in October shows that 48% of millennials and Generation Z think the country should publicly support Israel, while 12% of this group think that the United States should publicly criticize Israel. A whole generation is coming of age, and some of us are questioning the years of funding our government has sent to Israel. The United States has given $130 billion in aid since Israel's founding after World War II. Last year, we sent Israel $3.8 billion in military assistance. After the Hamas attacks, Biden requested an additional $14 billion for Israel. We want to know why we are still sending money despite the horrific scenes playing out in front of us. We don't want to be complicit in the human rights violations we are seeing on social media every day. Layla Saliba is a graduate student at Columbia and a Palestinian American. Multiple family members of hers have died in Gaza since October the 7th. She and Jones said they have been the targets of harassment because of their activism on behalf of Palestinians. Both told me they've appeared on Canary Mission, a website that exposes personal information of Gaza supporters. Saliba said she had to block one Columbia professor who harassed her on X, formerly Twitter. Saliba, who grew up wary of talking about her Palestinian background, noted that she has seen more pro-Palestinian conversation in recent months than ever before. "It's the first time we're seeing something like this on social media on our phones every day," she said. "And I think the level of death and destruction we're witnessing, I don't think the human brain is designed to deal with that. And that is something that is being funded by our tax dollars." Jones, on the other hand, is one of many young Jewish Americans who have been organizing to support the Palestinian people and bring attention to the cause through acts of civil disobedience that have disrupted travel routes and daily routines. Hundreds of young employees at Jewish organizations have signed a letter addressed to Biden and Congress demanding a ceasefire. For Jones, the claim that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic is disheartening. He said this makes it difficult to call out actual anti-Semitism. "People are going about calling anti-Zionism anti-Semitism, wearing a traditional Palestinian scarf, kaifa, anti-Semitic," Jones told me. "All these things that really aren't anti-Semitism, but they're painting it as that." Even as a person without direct ties to Israel or Gaza, conversations have been fraught. "It's frustrating that some people won't engage in genuine conversation about the destruction we're seeing on a regular basis. It's draining to face the reality of war as it unfolds and upsetting to know that we have contributed to that suffering." Biden and his campaign staff should be taking the call to action seriously. Voters in Michigan showed their disapproval of Biden's inaction in the region by voting uncommitted in the state's Democratic primary. Since then, voters in other states have used the protest vote as a means of voicing their feelings on Gaza. Gen Z progressives are trying to get Biden's attention. In March, a coalition sent a letter to the president outlining the youth agenda. It included an ask of Biden to call for a ceasefire. Gen Z for Change, one of the groups involved, has been helping voters email elected officials supporting a ceasefire. Recently, the president acknowledged pro-Palestinian protesters at a rally in North Carolina, saying that they have a point and that more care is needed in Gaza. Vice President Kamala Harris is on record supporting a 6-week ceasefire. Both are steps in the right direction. On the other hand, Biden is the sitting president of a world power. When he speaks, other leaders listen. Because of this, he needs to take an active stance in support of a ceasefire in the region. It isn't enough to have Harris deliver the message.
"My generation wants a quick fix on student debt. Not happening." This is written by Dace Potus, and he is an opinion fellow for USA Today, a graduate from DePaul University with a degree in political science. He's also president of the Lone Conservative, the largest conservative student-run publication in the country. "My generation has a political problem. We gravitate toward quick fixes for massive problems that plague our country. The generation raised on instant gratification, to little surprise, is looking for the same in politics and government. No other issue is this more apparent than the student loan crisis. Rather than targeting the root of the problem of federally subsidized student loans, President Joe Biden has instead pushed forward the Band-Aid fix of blanket student debt cancellation in order to scope a cheap political win with America's youth. On the 2020 campaign trail, candidate Biden championed his plan to immediately cancel a minimum of $10,000 of student debt per person. That empty promise appears to have worked the first time around, as he captured 65% of the Gen Z vote, compared with Trump, 31%. So is it any surprise that Biden's promise to eliminate student debt went on to be one of his administration's major policy moves? That might be why 77% of voters ages 18 to 29 said student debt relief was a motivating factor for their turnout in the midterm elections. On the issue of student loans, Gen Z probably favors blanket debt cancellation similar to Biden's proposed plan. Almost 60% of those born in 1997 or later support the plan that has since been struck down by the Supreme Court, compared with just 46% of all voters in swing states. Maddeningly, though, that same Bloomberg News Morning Consult survey reveals Gen Z is far less literate on the details of the plan than other generations, with 42% reporting they had heard not much or not at all of the plan, compared with just 30% of all other voters in swing states. I struggle to come up with a term to describe my generation on this issue besides entitled. Not only are we broadly in favor of other people paying off our debts, a majority of whom do not hold a bachelor's degree or higher, we don't even have the decency to be more aware of the issue than generations that are more likely to have already paid off their loans. A sobering truth for young Americans needs to be heard. You do not have the right to demand other people pay off your poor financial decisions. Biden's plan was not only unwise, but also unconstitutional at its core, as highlighted by the Supreme Court when it struck down the plan last June. While I think this course of action is unwise and immoral, Gen Z has a better chance of accomplishing debt relief through Congress, which is responsible for the power of the purse. Blanket cancellation does nothing to combat the problem of the student loan crisis. In fact, it would only serve as a further incentive for students to attend colleges they can't afford, obtaining degrees that give them little chance of allowing them to pay off the debt they accrued in the process. Congressional efforts are much better geared toward legislation curtailing the federal student lending programs that have gotten us into this mess in the first place. Our government's involvement in the student debt crisis is clearly unacceptable. Federal lending programs now offer aid to the vast majority of students. A 2017 study from the Federal Reserve indicates that for every dollar of federal student loans an institution receives, it's able to raise the cost of attendance by 60 cents. In a time when 37% of graduates report being unable to afford their monthly loan repayment, a short-term fix like cancellation will do nothing to prevent future generations from suffering the same fate. Young voters should look to other methods to sway their vote for actual change on the issue, not false promises attempting to bribe them. Gen Z should concentrate our efforts on voting for candidates who promise actual change on responsibility for financial decisions, understanding your financial decision in attending college rather than blaming politicians for not stealing other people's money to pay your debt is a much better use of your time and will lead to better results for your future. Scott?
Thank you, Doug. I will move on to the sports page, and here's what's on TV today. The National Hockey League at 6 p.m. on ESPN, it's Washington at Detroit. And at 8:30 p.m. on ESPN, it's Minnesota at Colorado. In the NBA at 6:30 p.m., you got on TNT, we've got Boston at Milwaukee. And at 9 p.m. on TNT, it's Golden State versus the Los Angeles Lakers. And in Major League Baseball at 1:10 p.m. on the Major League Baseball Network, you've got Baltimore at Boston. 6:07 p.m. on the MLB Network, it's Seattle at Toronto. 6:20 p.m. on MLB Network and ESPN Plus, it's the New York Mets at Atlanta. And at 9:05 p.m. on TBS, you've got the Chicago Cubs at the San Diego Padres. I'll read a short article here. Calipari to take over as coach at Arkansas. This is written by Steve Gardner of USA Today. In a major college basketball shakeup, John Calipari is leaving the University of Kentucky to take over at SEC rival Arkansas, according to a person with knowledge of the deal. The person who spoke to USA Today's Dan Wolken on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. Calipari will receive a five-year contract to replace Eric Musselman, who exited Fayetteville to accept the job at Southern Cal. despite reaching the Final Four four times in five seasons from 2011 to 2015. Calipari's status at Kentucky seemed to be in jeopardy after the Wildcat lost to number 14 seed Oakland in this year's NCAA tournament. However, athletic director Mitch Barnhart appeared to put those questions to rest when he announced Calipari would return next year for a 16th season in Lexington. Calipari, age 65, has been to six Final Fours and been named Naismith Coach of the Year three times. He was inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame in 2015.
And here's a lead story on the top of the page. NCAA title game loss exposes Iowa women's need for more depth. It's written by Chad Listikow, and the dateline is Cleveland. May not get through all of this article, but come close. The start of Iowa's NCAA tournament title game couldn't have been scripted any better. After South Carolina missed a challenge shot, Kate Martin boxed out 6'2" Chloe Kitts for a textbook rebound. Martin offered an outlet pass to Caitlin Clark, who on her first touch of the game dribbled twice and flung a long chest pass to Hannah Stolke in the opposite free throw lane. Stolke spun and whipped a left-handed pass to Sydney Affolder, who from the left sideline quickly slipped a short pass to the arriving Martin at the three-point line. Martin squared up and uncorked a high-arching three-pointer over 6'7" Camilla Cardoso. Swish! For a 3-0 Iowa lead. Re-watch that play, and you'll also see Affolter attacking the rim and curling her body inside a South Carolina defender to be in position for a potential offensive rebound. Those things highlighted exactly what Iowa needed to do to spring the upset against the unbeaten Gamecocks. Hawkeyes had to score in the transition with their elite ball movement, had to hit a high number of threes, and had to be as competitive as possible on the glass. Impressively, Iowa's hot start continued. Martin's first mid-range jumper was true. Affolter raced up court after another defensive rebound and scored in transition with her left hand. Clark buried her first three-point try of the game from the right wing for a 10-0 Hawkeyes uppercut. All those things also highlighted that Iowa, at its best, was capable for a second straight year of taking down Dawn Staley and South Carolina. We were excited. We were ready, fifth-year senior guard Gabby Marshall said after her Iowa record 166th career game. We kept telling each other to play free, play loose. We don't have anything to lose. Just go do what you do out there to the best of your ability. That's why we started off so hot, she said. At its core, this was a great Iowa team. But in part due to injuries, this was not a deep Iowa team by the end of a grueling NCAA tournament and 39-game schedule. And the team on the other bench was arguably one of the deepest teams in women's basketball history. How deep? The Gamecocks' leading soccer Sunday was Tessa Johnson. Leading scorer Sunday was Tessa Johnson with 19 points. She was the team's ninth leading scorer for the season. Raven Johnson led South Carolina with 36 minutes. Cardoso, 15 points, 17 rebounds, played 30. Seven other Gamecocks played between 14 and 25 minutes. Fresher, longer bodies eventually overwhelmed the Hawkeyes. Meantime, Iowa used Marshall, Clark, and Martin for every second, 39 minutes and 40 seconds, until taking the seniors out with 20 seconds to go. Affolder played 35. This was after all five Iowa starters played 37-plus minutes in Friday night's 71-69 win over UConn that ended just before midnight in Cleveland. While Iowa was able to outrun LSU in the Elite Eight despite a short bench, South Carolina was a far taller, deeper challenge. We were hitting a lot of our shots and had our transition game going a little bit, Affolter said of the fast start, which continued to a 20-9 lead while Iowa's legs were still springy. But we were playing so hard in the post to get rebounds. Those girls are great basketball players, obviously very strong, very tall. It takes a lot. We can't guard 6'7" when you're 6 foot, or when we're 6 foot. It's just hard. But I think we battled the whole entire game. Iowa Associate Head Coach Jan Jensen knew the Hawkeyes wouldn't be able to out-rebound Cardoso, the 6'7 center, when their only starter taller than 6 feet is the 6'2 Stolke. You have to hit threes at a high rate. You have to limit everybody else on the boards. You can't limit Cardoso, Jensen said. We didn't limit the others. Repeated putbacks not only were a constant stream of 2 points for South Carolina, but demoralizing for Iowa. The Gamecocks wound up with a whopping 51-29 advantage in rebounds. Iowa's mid-range shots that went in early began to miss. Clark started 3-for-4 from three-point land in the first quarter, but went 2-for-9 the rest of the way. Even so, the Hawkeyes were within 5 points in the game's final 4.5 minutes. We were playing with that mentality all game, Affolter said. Just fight, fight, fight. Every possession matters so much. The biggest difference, South Carolina scored 37 bench points to Iowa's 0. The 13 minutes Iowa got from Addison O'Grady and 5 from Kylie Feuerbach were unproductive. And when fresher legs are guarding tired legs, it's no wonder that Iowa hit only 17 of 48 shots. After an 8 of 15 first quarter, that saw it take a 27-20 lead. To be able to have all those fresh legs on Caitlin was really tough, Iowa head coach Lisa Bluder said. And not only their depth, their height. I'm not just talking about their centers. They're really pretty big at every position, which makes it hard. They could recover really well when we attempted threes. This game was a reminder of just how good Clark is to elevate this team into this elite spot 2 years in a row, and that it was quite the feat that the Hawkeyes in last year's Final Four still are the only team to beat South Carolina in the past 81 games. At that point, Iowa needed to play a close, flawless game of Sunday, but the task and the opponent was just too tall and too deep. At that point, you've got to basically shoot perfect to win, Clark said. So much to be proud of, so much to hold our head high about. It stings, but life goes on. And it ends by saying, lack of depth was the ultimate key Sunday. If Iowa could have had a healthy Molly Davis and more explosive size in the middle against South Carolina, maybe things would have been a bit different. Building quality depth going forward could be the Iowa key to future sustained success. Scott?
B. Workplace tension builds after dust-up with manager. Dear Abby, I'm a soft-spoken person. I work in a medical laboratory, and I am finally speaking up for what I believe in after years of social anxiety and depression. At the last meeting, when asked by the manager for suggestions to improve the lab workflow, I spoke up. Fast forward to tonight, when I expressed some excitement about my idea, the site leader, a different manager, shot my idea down, saying, "It's not going to make a difference." This isn't the first time she has made me feel like my ideas are dumb or that I'm not intelligent, and I snapped. I asked her what ideas she had, and she looked as if I offended her, but she's done this numerous times since she came here. Meanwhile, she has her favorite person in the lab who gets away with murder. Was I wrong for getting upset at her? I just feel like my suggestions go unnoticed or are scoffed at, but when another person comes up with something similar, she applauds them. Signed, Had Enough in the Midwest. Dear Had Enough in the Midwest, blowing up at the manager may have felt good at the moment after years of silence caused by depression and social anxiety, but it was the wrong thing to do. That kind of behavior does not belong in a professional environment. Favoritism happens in many work environments, and it can be frustrating. If you can't find a way to accept it, you might be happier working at a different lab. And our second letter, Dear Abby, my stepdaughter has 2 children. She married a man who has 1 child, Haley. They have been married 4 years, and Haley turned 18 last year. We have seen her only 5 or 6 times, and she seems uninterested in getting to know us. The first Christmas, I went out of my way to give her gifts. I thought she would enjoy as a teenager. The next Christmas, she didn't spend any time with the family, so I sent a gift home with her dad, but never heard a word from her. Last year, Haley graduated from high school and started working. Because we weren't going to see them at Christmas, I sent the other grandchildren gifts but did not include Haley. My stepdaughter got upset because we left Haley out. We explained that 1, she never acknowledges the gifts we send, and 2, she is now an adult, and 3, we never see her. Are we wrong not to include her? Signed, Perplexed About Stepfamily Etiquette. Abby writes, Dear Perplexed, the answer to your question is yes and no. Haley doesn't appear to be a child who is easy to love. She has certainly given you no reason to. However, in the interest of family harmony, it was wrong to exclude her entirely. Not knowing the young woman, it would be hard to know what she might have liked to receive. Next year, send her a coffee shop gift card with a sweet note so she won't feel she is being ignored as she has ignored you. And a final note, Abby says, to my Muslim readers, at sundown, it is time for the breaking of the Ramadan fast. Happy Eid al-Fitr, everyone. Love, Abby.
Thank you, Scott. A little weather wrap before we close it for today. Today, a high of 67 here in Des Moines. 43 would be the low. Tomorrow, 70, mostly cloudy. Then we go to Thursday, 61, 65, 79, down the road. It's going to look like a nice week as far as the weather goes. So that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been Scott Slavik. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device or any time at the iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.